The US dollar has been devalued through inflation by over 90% in the last 50 years.
There are waves of technology that happen where there's amazing tailwinds of value creation and opportunity.
Brad Garlinghouse, the CEO of Ripple Labs, a blockchain payment solutions company.
If you're not taking risk, you're dying. If we're not failing a little bit, we're not trying hard enough.
What are some of the nuggets you've discovered on how to actually attract and land A-plus talent?
A players want to put their dent in the universe. You can't get them with money. One of my favorite profiles of hiring A talent is to hire failed entrepreneurs.
9 years in probably the most volatile industry we've ever seen. What has been the highest high and what's been the lowest low for you?
If you go back to when we got sued, it was a pretty dark time at Ripple. Learning that we had won all the things that we cared about, not just for Ripple, but for the industry, that was a big high.
If you could get the whole world to believe one thing, what would you want the world to believe?
Comparison is the thief of joy. Understanding that your happiness is not dependent upon someone else's happiness is super critical to the world.
Any predictions you have in the next cycle? Oof. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the World Class Podcast. Today, I sit down with legendary executive and crypto pioneer, Brad Garlinghouse. Brad is the CEO of Ripple Labs, a blockchain-based payment solutions company with a market cap north of $26 billion. Prior to Ripple, Brad was the CEO at Hightail, president at AOL, and senior executive at Yahoo. And in this interview, we really dive into his turbulent story, leading Ripple through lawsuits into success. We talk about how to build a world-class team and company culture, the importance of taking risk, as well as Brad's predictions for the crypto market in the future. So without further ado, let's dive in. Hey, Brad, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I'm excited, man. So we have a lot of stuff to cover here. You've had an incredible career as a Web2 executive, some of the biggest companies out there, Yahoo, AOL, and then you took an unprecedented move for most people. And I think 2015, you joined Ripple.
Yeah.
Before it was the cool thing to do, before anyone knew that crypto would be what it is today. Can you walk us through, like, what evidence did you find that gave you the conviction to pivot out of Web2 into crypto in 2015 before it was the smart thing to do?
Well, I will start by sharing a brief anecdote that I think you'll get some humor out of. You probably know a guy who also now lives here in Miami, Mike Arrington. And Mike Arrington has been a friend for a long time. And he said to me, he's like, Brad, in a long string of bad professional decisions, going to Ripple is your worst. He literally, when I took the job, he was like, what the hell are you doing? And I'll say, there are a whole bunch of people in crypto who I really, at that time, even in 2014, 2015, when I was thinking about this, who frankly advised me against it. You know, for me to answer your core question, like I think there are waves of technology that happen that tend to last, let's call it 20 years, where there's amazing tailwinds of value creation and opportunity. I finished business school in 1997, which was an amazingly good time to come out of business school, given the birth of the internet, kind of in the really the 1.0. And not surprisingly, perhaps there's a whole bunch of people from my business school class doing really interesting things in crypto, not the least of which is the CEO of Amazon, the guy named Andy Jassy. And I feel like one of the waves that is unfolding now is crypto and blockchain. I thought that 10 years ago. I had been exposed to Bitcoin in about 2012, and I owned some Bitcoin. But one of the things I always had this in my head is it's like, okay, wait a minute. Are we really going to rebuild the entire system devoid of government, devoid of banks? And I felt like that was a limiting factor. And so when I first heard about what Ripple was trying to do and trying to be really a bridge between traditional finance and what we're, you know, calling Web3 today, I thought, okay, this makes a lot of sense. And so the last thing I'll say about this, and I'll, you know, turn it back to you, but I also think risk tolerance is an important thing to think about in life. And at different times in your life, your risk tolerance should be higher or lower. It depends upon who you are, what's going on in your life, you know, all those things. You know, by the time in 2015, you know, I had been working in the, you know, tech space for 18 years. I had done well. And I had an opportunity actually to go work at Uber. And this is 2014, 2015. And that would have been a good outcome, meaning, you know, I felt like, okay, I don't know if they were public yet, but it was right around that time. And I felt like, you know, okay, that's going to be a good base hit, maybe a double. But is that going to change my life in any real way? And I was at a point where I'm like, was willing to take risk. And I thought, you know, the likelihood that what Ripple's doing is going to be successful is probably pretty low. But if it worked, the returns and the opportunity to have an impact was much, 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 much higher.
That's a great way of thinking about it. We just talked about that with Elon too, with SpaceX and some of his ideas. It's like those asymmetric returns, you have to have a higher risk profile. And I think he mentioned there's like a 10% chance SpaceX would actually succeed. But he said the work was so important to drive the world forward that I just had to do what was required. So you're at that unique inflection point. Why, what, I guess for those who don't know as well, like what exactly is Ripple?
Yeah.
And why do you think Ripple is so important in the future of crypto?
So I'm going to go back to how Ripple was kind of envisioned way back in 2015 when I joined. And the whole thing came to fruition. I got a recruiting call. And I, you know, frankly, was avoiding the recruiter for a while, and a guy I like, but I just was, when I say I was busy, I wasn't. I was driving for Uber at the time, just because I was bored.
But, driving from Uber. But
his point to me is like, look, Brad, you've never met Chris Larson. Chris Larson is a guy who had started Elon. He had started Prosper. And Chris is just an exceptionally good, and just the ability to see around corners and where the world's going is a talent. And really, he has way more vision around that than I do. And when I met with him, he kept talking about this thing, an internet of value. And I had not heard that expression. And he was talking about like all the different ways that value movement has friction that we've become a little bit numb to. I mean, this is going to sound a little bit pedestrian, but like I have to take my credit card out of my pocket. I have to take my wallet out to pay for something as opposed, that's friction.
Yeah.
It's friction there. They're also taking, I mean, somewhere between 100 bips and in some countries, 800 bips for the privilege of processing that credit card. And so he's talking about all the different points of friction where an internet of value, if it existed, it would unlock use cases we don't even think about. I'll share one that, you know, may never come to fruition, but I remember him kind of pontificating about this, and that, why not a self-driving car? If we get to the point of truly self-driving cars, and I think that's not if, but when, why not be able to pass value to the car in front of you to get out of the way so you can go faster? You're in rush hour traffic and you want to go a little bit faster. You're willing to pay whatever amount, and you could even put into some sort of, you know, system. I'm willing to pay this much to go this fast, and it would moderate based upon that. You would pass value to the cars around you.
Fascinating.
Today you can't do that unless you're pitching dimes into somebody's convertible, right? Like it's not even pragmatic.
Right. Yeah.
But you think about, okay, in a internet of value, if value truly can move the way information moves today, mm-hmm. Okay. Now, look, there's a whole bunch of reasons why you could poke holes in that. That's never going to happen. And you know, it creates weird incentives for going slow and getting paid to get out of the way kind of thing. But he really kind of introduced this idea of this internet of value and how it, for that to exist, you need certain oil in that engine to grease the system so that it can work. And it, you know, XRP, the digital asset that Ripple has kind of standardized on, if you will, extremely fast, extremely low cost, and it could be an interesting use case for that. So I think there's going to be lots of cryptos that win. You and I have talked about that before. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think there'll be different use cases and different protocols and different technologies that will win. But his vision and kind of what he talked about and bridging the kind of traditional financial world with this next generation, at the time we weren't calling it Web3, it really appealed to me. Well, one last thing I'll say about this that I think is something I thought about. I don't think there's that many times in your life where you get to do something where you really can, to borrow a Steve Jobs expression, put a dent in the universe. There have been a couple of times in my career where I feel like I've had that opportunity, but it's pretty rare. It's pretty unique. And when I thought about what Ripple is trying to do, it's one of these kind of audacious things of like, okay, we're going to enable an internet of value. We're going to build systems to catalyze that future vision. It's a definitely one of those things. You're like, okay, if we do that, that's going to change the way some of these systems operate. And you're going to feel like I helped put a dent in the universe. And there's something I find personally gratifying about that, that it's not in kind of as Elon Musk for him, I think it was about, as you described, like it's important work for the world.
Yeah.
You know, I think if you can unlock an internet of value, it's going to change a lot about how some of these things work. And I mean, you know, passing money for self-driving cars, okay. But, you know, there's also an underserved community that is not connected to the traditional financial system that has, if they could connect, could drive value. And you're seeing some of that play out with microloans in less successful economies. And that is helping people. Like, yeah. I think that there is an element, if you can really do this at scale, there's a lot of benefits to society that I think we underappreciate right now.
That's a great way of putting it. You've been at this for 9 years now, right?
I just passed my ninth anniversary.
9 years in probably the most volatile industry we've ever seen. I'm curious for you, over that 9 year period, what has been the highest high and what's been the lowest low for you?
You know, the highest high, which admittedly was a in and of itself an emotional roller coaster, and I have a tattoo referencing it on my left shoulder, July 13th, 2023, the court decision was issued by Judge Torres in the United States versus Ripple and I guess to some degree Brad Garlinghouse. I mean, there are three cases really, one against me, one against Chris, and one against Ripple. And you know, look, I think there's so many things about this that made no sense from the beginning that you couldn't really understand. But, you know, when your life is in the hands of a judge, you don't really know. I mean, I believed deeply that we were right. But that moment, learning that we had, from my point of view, won all the things that we cared about, frankly, not just for Ripple, but for the industry, that was a big moment. That was a big high. But even that moment was an emotional roller coaster. I actually don't mind sharing. I haven't shared this publicly. I broke down crying.
Wow.
And because it was definitely like the weight of it. All of a sudden it was like, oh my God, like, you know, all of this energy, all this time, all this money.
For
all
years.
This distraction. Oh yeah. Yeah. And so, well, I'll do the other, the lowest low. To some degree, December 22nd, 2020, which is the day they filed the lawsuit. No, that wasn't the same because, you know, when we won on July 13th, we didn't know the decision was coming out that day. You know, I mean, it was definitely
out of the blue.
Yes. Yeah.
That's remarkable. I'm curious because, well, congrats on winning that. That's power to the people here. I love it. But when that lawsuit was first filed, it's so tough because you have such conviction of the future and what you can do for the world. But then you have the SEC, you have other law institutions that it's completely up in the air whether or not you're able to do this. And then internally with your company, you sold them on a vision, they're bought and they know what the technology can do, but there's so many unknowns there. How do you keep your team engaged and convicted in the midst of so much uncertainty and chaos and persecution? Like, how do you keep the team together and charge forward to get where you are today through all that?
Yeah. Two things come to mind. One, one of the values at Ripple, we have an acronym we use, Legos. You know, one of them is, the last one is say it. We are a very transparent organization. And so I think one of the ways, particularly in that time, and again, if you go back to when we got sued, it was a pretty dark time at Ripple. We had very high attrition the next two quarters. You know, we weren't really sure, like, okay, can we still sell into customers?
Yeah.
Which it turned out outside the United States, we definitely could. Inside the United States, that was a different story. But I think making sure the team felt they were part of the journey, and, you know, we really over-indexed on transparency about what was going on. And wanted everyone to feel like, hey, here's exactly what we know and what we don't know. And I think people felt part of the mission. They felt part of, you know, if anything, ironically, it brought us together.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
That shared suffering.
For sure. Shared suffering, shared enemy.
Shared enemy.
the United States Securities Exchange Commission picked on Ripple. Like, of all the different things you could pick on, you know, I mean, we were actively working with governments around the world, and it's like, you know, it's still to this day, it's a strange, like, why? Like, you know, you'd think you'd pick weaker players. And I think they were surprised that we were just like, absolutely not. We are not rolling over. I mean, another thing which is sort of known publicly, but I had the opportunity personally to settle for what I would call relatively de minimis amount of money, where I could have just been out of it.
Really?
I could have been out of it. Chris Larson would have been out of it. They wouldn't do that with Ripple. But so, you know, what they're doing is trying to manipulate the narrative. Hey, we settled with the CEO, we settled with the chairman, but, you know, we're going to go after Ripple. They're a bad actor. It looks bad. But, you know, it would have been, relative to where I was financially, it would have been de minimis. And frankly, for my life sanity of stress and, you know, maybe a better decision. It took, you know, and Chris and I had a lot of one-on-one personal conversations. Like, we're all in this together. And, you know, for one of us to have folded, you know, it would have been tough for the company to stand in the face of that onslaught with, you know, that. And so it was kind of an all for one, one for all thing. And
I love that. That's inspiring as hell.
Yeah. I mean, it was, but like, I don't want people to take away that like, oh, this was a no brainer. It was just like, particularly because I feel like the SEC was, I feel malicious and manipulative and trying to get us to settle.
Yeah.
To create a narrative that Ripple's been a bad actor in some way.
I don't think people can fully empathize with how crazy of an adversary the United States government can be, and then the pressure that puts on a CEO like you in that position. So I'm curious for you, because there's a lot of founders out here listening to this that are going through their own shit, but might not be a fraction of the intensity of that. I'm curious from your standpoint, how did you stay mentally strong? Did you have any particular habits or
you're
systems?
Assuming I did stay mentally strong.
Well, you ended up lasting long enough to get here, but I'm curious, like, what was that like for you? And like, how did you navigate that and, you know, parlay that into advice for other CEOs navigating their own uncertainties?
I mean, look, it takes conviction for sure.
Yeah.
I thought I was right. And, and we were in a position, Ripple, the company, was in a financial position where we could fight. And I think, you know, one of the hard things about what has happened in the crypto space is the SEC has been a bully. I mean, like, that's the right word. They're a bully because they go after weak players. And to your earlier point about the adversary of the SEC, I mean, one of the biggest problems here is they're not a rational capitalistic actor. There's no downside for them spending another $100 million of time and energy and resource to file the appeal. Like, it's a little like, if you're running a company and you sue Ripple and you lose a couple of different things, which they have lost repeatedly against Ripple, you probably are like, okay, I'm out. Like,
not worth it. Yeah.
That natural incentive structure that exists in capitalism doesn't exist with a government actor. The people who brought the case, there's no negative outcome to them.
Yeah.
They were gone by the time the SEC lost. The people who continue to fight the case, there's no downside to them. The budgets. And so, you know, people ask, well, you know, will the SEC, you know, continue to fight this fight? And it's like, well, I mean, to some degree, until there's a new administration, and I mean the SEC administration more than the White House.
Yes, definitely.
They're all in on fighting this fight, and there's no negative consequence to Gary Gensler to keep fighting the fight.
No, you're right.
Does it cost him a dime?
What do you think about the future in that regards then? Like, do you feel like the SEC is powerful enough to curtail the crypto industry as a whole, or do you think it's a matter of time?
Oh, they're going to lose in the long run.
They're going to lose in the long run. Just enough
this
time.
This is just, I mean, look, if you look at the continued growth of crypto as a multi-decade arc of time, this is nothing.
This is nothing.
It's a speed bump. Because I'm so optimistic about what the future of crypto looks like, we'll look back in 20 years and be like, God, that sucked. But you know what? Little bump, whatever. In my opinion, the market will be measured in many, 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 many trillions.
Yeah.
And it will change the way many, many transactions work, because it's a way to reduce friction, reduce cost, make things more efficient. It's going to win in the long run. The best technology usually wins in the long run.
Yeah.
And I think crypto you know, represents that. So I think it's unfortunate as a US citizen to see the US fall behind. You know, you think about the geopolitical benefits to the United States and the United States economy that Internet 1.0 and Internet, you know, Web 2.0 really were US-centric phenomena. And now Web 3.0, the US is doing everything we can to make sure it's not a US-centric phenomena.
That's kind of crazy to me because we've always been at the forefront.
And massive
trends.
Value creation to be at the forefront.
Massive value creation, unprecedented.
Entrepreneurs, the smartest entrepreneurs around the world want to come to the United States. In Web3, I mean, one of the first things I tell people that come to me and say, hey, I'm thinking about starting a company, I'm like, don't incorporate the United States. Mm. Why would you do that with a hostile government? You know, the SEC has led the charge, but the OCC, I mean, look, why is it a political talking point about crypto? Why is Elizabeth Warren, she's saying things are just not fact-based.
Yeah.
It's like, look, you can say all you want about the things Trump says.
It's a script.
Like, it's like, this doesn't even make sense.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even understand
why
it's
do you think the government is so afraid of Web3? Is it because it threatens their very existence and power structures where it's peer-to-peer, it's permissionless, they can no longer manipulate in the same way? Do you think it threatens their power structures? Or why would we not get behind this as a government?
I mean, Chris, I wish I thought they were even smart enough to see some of the things you're saying. And I don't think that's it, because you have, you know, leading governments, a bunch of G20 governments around the world leaning in. So if it was that people worried about permissionless, if those were the issues, you'd see more G20 governments expressing lots of angst. But you know, look, the UK is leaning in. Singapore is leaning in. The UAE is leaning in.
Yeah.
I mean, frankly, Europe, Mika is kind of leaning in and saying these are here to stay. Look, Brazil is not a G20 market, I don't think, but the Brazilian government's totally leaning in.
Yeah.
So, you know, why is it the US? I mean, there's lots of things about the US political system that I can't explain. So I think we skipped that part of the discussion. But, you know, the support of innovation should be a bipartisan issue.
Absolutely.
Support of high value job creation should be a bipartisan issue. Why did this become partisan? How did it become partisan? I mean, the answer to my agree is somewhat Elizabeth Warren. Elizabeth Warren decided to make it some sort of talking point, I guess, in kind of an anti-capitalism way. Yeah. I'm not 100% sure, but some of the things I hear come out of Elizabeth Warren's office, I'm just like, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
It's just kind of saying that everyone who used the internet in 1995 is a bad actor. I mean, do bad actors take advantage of new technologies? Yes. And they will continue to do so. And AI will be the next wave of bad guys using these technologies in bad ways. That doesn't mean we should get rid of AI. It doesn't mean we should get rid of it.
Exactly. They're like, this can be used for trafficking and for arms dealing. I'm like, well, guess what currency is the number one right now? It's the US dollar.
Exactly. Right. I mean? Yeah.
It's crazy. So I'm curious for you now, sitting where we're at, I think Bitcoin or the industry as a whole, I think is at what, $2.5 trillion?
Yeah, right around there.
Market cap, roughly. Yeah. I guess just from your angle, you got a lot more intel and perspective than most, I'd say, in this industry. Like, where do you think we're going to be at the end of this cycle? Like, how big do you think the macro picture is going to look like? Any predictions you have in the next cycle?
Well, so I like the fact that you're saying cycle and not putting a specific time frame on it. Yeah. I think I've been in crypto, you know, really for maybe, you know, over 10 years since I've owned Bitcoin, but, you know, 9 years at Ripple. The thing that's really hard for me to predict are the timelines.
Correct.
And so when I hear people are trading crypto, I always think, oof, I don't think I could trade crypto. I mean, there's some patterns that I feel like I see, but you know, I give my closest friends the advice of just like, you know, you got to think long-term. You can't think about where this is going to be in 5 weeks or 5 months. You know, where is it going to be in 5 years? I mean, frankly, I mean, I'd like to be able to say, like, think about where it's going to be in 50 years. And that goes into some core macro principles that I believe incredibly strongly in, which is we, unfortunately, as citizens of the world, can't trust our governments to manage monetary supply in a long-term responsible way. There's a lot of evidence to support that sentence, right? The US dollar, arguably the best managed currency in the world, has been devalued through inflation by, you know, over 90% in the last 50 years.
Is it 90% in the last 50 years?
If you do that, like just an adjusted, what was it? What's $100,000
purchasing power?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Incredible.
So, you know, do we think that's going to get better or worse?
Wow. With the printing press.
I think it's probably going to get worse.
Yeah. Makes sense.
And that's the best managed currency. And by the way, we can argue about that. Actually, I should retract that a little bit. One of the best managed currencies. I mean, yeah. US dollars, I think many would say, if not the best and most.
And we're the reserve currency. Yeah. It's,
yeah. But I mean, and that's the best one. So right. I think it's inevitable. Like, and it's inevitable that, you know, now right now we're talking about is $2.5 trillion. You know, look, do I think this is an easy 10X over the next 5 to 10 years? Yeah. No problem. That doesn't freak me out when I say that at all.
Like, and that's conservative. If you
that,
just,
that feels safe.
Safe.
I mean, to the earlier conversation about asymmetric returns, is there a chance that it's 100x in that time frame? That feels aggressive, but I don't know. Like, I think that many people in the United States, particularly, don't understand what it would be like to have lived in Argentina and have the Argentinian peso devalued effectively to zero multiple times in my lifetime.
Mm.
Why would you hold that currency?
We don't realize that could become us.
That's exactly the point, right? Like, I think that we underestimate what that macro dynamic looks like over the long term. And so I'm, you know, incredibly bullish. The reason I'm dodging the question only slightly because what's the timeline for this year? I mean, I have said publicly, I think that the market will be over 5 trillion by the end of this year, which is a double from where we are now. How that applies to Bitcoin versus XRP. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, people forget before the SEC got involved and said that ETH is not a security, XRP was the second most valuable digital asset.
Wow. That was,
and that wasn't that long ago.
That wasn't long ago. What, 3-4 years?
It was 2018 Hinman gave his speech. So 6 years, a little less than 6 years ago. Yeah. Five years and change. And, you know, look, when a government actor gets involved, you know, markets change and maybe that's to be expected.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you still have that government actor involved. Unfortunately, you still see, and I believe what I read usually, mm-hmm. you know, look, it appears the SEC is trying to mount a case against ETH. You know, to me, that's absurd. To me, that's like, you've already lost a bunch. Why would you keep fighting this fight?
Yeah.
But, you know, look, it unfortunately, I don't think the US government should be putting their hands on the scale of winners and losers. In the long run, I think the best technologies applied with the best use cases, delivering the best utility, that they'll win. And, you know, what that looks like over the next 10 years, like, we can debate, but I'm very optimistic about the market.
Do you think there's any black swans?
Yeah.
Have you thought through any use cases? Like,
well, but you mean black swans on the positive or the negative?
Both, actually.
I guess, is it a black swan if it's on
maybe
the positive?
It's a white swan?
A white swan,
yeah, I don't know, whatever they'd call that, but like, yeah, I guess any unconventional, unorthodox, but like massive events that could really swing things one way or the other.
I mean, I think there will be events that are very difficult to predict. You know, maybe people can make fun of me, but I would have told you, let me think back to it. I guess it was 2 years ago, April 2 years ago,
mm-hmm.
FTX held a conference in the Bahamas.
I was there. Yeah.
I was there as well. I remember leaving that conference thinking, like, wow, FTX has emerged in a relatively short amount of time as like one of the power players in crypto. And I was impressed. I would have said at that time that FTX and Binance were the two most important, most influential, and probably SBF and CZ were the two most important players in crypto. Now you've got one definitively in jail, one, I guess, potentially headed to jail. And, you know, I bring this up in context of black swans is like, it's hard to know. But on the positive, think about the freaking resilience of this industry and market that 2 years ago, somebody who I thought I knew a lot about what's going on in crypto, I would have said these are the two most important companies. The CEOs of the two most important companies now either are in jail or I think headed there.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in some ways, I mean, I don't, the CZ stuff I'm less close to. And so I don't know as many details, but look, the resilience of the market that should give us immense optimism.
Yes.
About what's coming. Do I think there's gonna be another black swan? Of course, 100%. I just don't know exactly what it is. The only one that's going to be an interesting one to watch, and I don't even know how he calls a black swan, because I feel like black swan by definition can't really be like
predicted. Oh,
didn't see that happening.
Yeah.
The US government is going after Tether.
Mm.
That is clear to me. I view Tether as a very important part of the ecosystem, and I don't know how to predict
the impact that will have on the rest of the ecosystem.
Yeah.
Is it possible to take out Bitcoin, for instance? Like, do you think there's any sort of technological thing that could take out Bitcoin, high performance computing or quantum computing or any, there's a lot of rumors out there, but I'm curious from a technologist standpoint too, is like, are there any existential threats to the core asset propping this entire ecosystem up?
Yeah. I'm not smart enough to say yes.
Yeah.
I would say, look, as much as I think Chris Larson is genius level being able to see around corners about where the world's going, David Schwartz, the chief technology officer at Ripple and really one of the architects of the XRP ledger, I mean, this guy's genius level on technology that I'm just like, I'm in awe of, being able to work with him. I did call him once and I'm like, I had had some conversation with somebody who's in quantum computing and I was kind of like, should I be worried about this? And he walked me through why he felt this isn't like a little bit like that's a red herring. That's not a real thing. And he kind of explained to me why he felt that way. And so I won't bore people with kind of some of his arguments here, but I think there will be black swans. I don't think one of them is going to be the risk of quantum computing to the crypto market at large.
For people that aren't as deep into crypto and they're like curious, they're seeing there's a there obviously now. Who are some of the people that you really respect and admire kind of leading the charge in the crypto movement as a whole that you think people should be checking out?
I'm going to transparently kind of dodge this question a little bit. And the reason is some of the people I respect the most are intentionally behind the scenes.
Oh, interesting.
There's some people who I have immense respect for. And admittedly, I will share with you, some of them are kind of what I'd call Bitcoin maximalists.
Yeah.
But I respect the hell out of them. And, they have chosen for a host of reasons that they're going to be in the background and try to influence. I will say, there's times when I would prefer that myself, but I also, but I will also say like the industry needs spokespeople.
Yeah.
They need leaders who are stepping forward and representing the industry with central governments around the world, with treasury, central banks around the world. We can't all just be anonymous Satoshi Nakamoto's. I don't know who Satoshi Nakamoto is, just to be clear. I'm not pretending that. But I do know a bunch of people I have immense respect for who I think have had a very important in getting this industry to where it is. They just choose to stay in the background.
I respect that. I like that. I want to transition a bit more too on your operating career as a CEO, company builder. We had a dinner, I don't know, probably six,
maybe longer,
maybe even a year ago. I can't remember when the dinner was, but it was, I think, 14 CEOs and some really interesting things came up in that dinner. And I remember walking away. I'm like, shit, this guy really knows how to operate companies. I got to talk to this guy more. One thing you've mentioned in the past that I thought was somewhat contrarian. You're like, companies aren't democracies. They're benevolent dictatorships.
My team loves it when I say that.
I love that. Can you unpack that for us? What does that mean to you and how a company is and should be run?
Well, I mean, I will start by saying, I don't think there's one size fits all. And when I hear like how it should be run, I kind of hear that. And I think, the way a Steve Jobs ran an organization versus the way Brad Garlinghouse runs an organization are different. I'm in awe of what Steve Jobs created over decades with Apple. I'm in awe of Elon Musk. I'm in awe of, we could go down the list. So I think it's frankly would be arrogant of me to say that the way it should be run. Now, that being said, and on your kind of core, I think one of the mistakes that some frankly, younger CEOs sometimes make. And but that's also a generalization that maybe I should not say, because
when you're less experienced, typically.
Yeah. Like, management is not a popularity contest. It is not a democracy. Just because everyone thinks X, at the end of the day, I very much, I think my team would back this statement up. I listen a lot and I am always interested in people's perspectives. But at the end of the day, it's not a vote. This is where I think it's important to take the company. And that's the privilege and the curse of being a CEO. Sometimes you're wrong. Sometimes you're right. I've certainly made mistakes. I'm sure I'll make more. I have a team around me who I hope is giving me the best counsel they can. And I hope I'm listening as best I can. But I think one of the mistakes people make is that they try too hard to be popular. Mm. I mean, think about it, like Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos is in a position as a shareholder of Amazon to ignore the quarterly stress for a long time. Like, a lot of CEOs would have folded under the pressure of the expectations around quarterly earnings that would have prevented Amazon from being what it is today. That is an example of, it was not a democracy. He didn't care what these people were saying. He had a vision of what he was going to do, and wow. Right. And I think, the irony, of course, is the SEC is what has created the construct that drives these quarterly dynamics. And there's a lot of good reasons for that. And there has been frauds and there have been bad actors.
Yeah.
But it also, in some ways, has limited how we are building and creating value and creating amazing customer experiences and changing the way the world works. So yeah. Some people are more dictator than benevolent.
Yeah.
You
gotta find your style.
Yeah. And there's not just one size fits all, and that's okay.
Yeah. That's the challenging part. I'm curious for you personally, what's the hardest part of being a CEO?
I think one of the things that people don't fully understand, it's not just, I guess it's lonely. You don't have, and I think there's the reason why some of these organizations are created. I'm a part of YPO. And, I think people forget that, like, as you move up, when I was at Yahoo, I had a bunch of peers, like, we were in it together and, I could commiserate and we could talk about stuff. But as you go up, there's fewer people until you're the CEO and then, like, you're one. And in some ways you can use your board as sounding boards on things, but, in some ways that's not a perfect, they're not on your team exactly the same way. And so I think one of the hardest things is just understanding that it can be lonely and kind of growing into that over time.
Interesting. Is that something you just learn to deal with, or are there things that you can do to, like, combat that, or
meditation?
Yeah. I'm doing about an hour a day every day.
I think exercise for me, when I first started to feel those experiences, I used to do triathlons, and that was my meditation at that time, in a different way. Mm-hmm. But I don't have great advice on this. Like, it's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Yeah. I like that. That's real. When it comes to building these companies, right? Because you've got Yahoo, AOL, Ripple, Hightail, I think formerly known as YouSendIt.
Yep.
You've operated a lot of different companies. Everyone talks about building A-plus teams, right? Hire A players, build world-class teams. You build the team, then they build the product, and they make the company great. Throughout all your operating experiences, I'm curious, like, what are some of the nuggets you've discovered on how to actually attract and land A-plus talent?
When you talk about that, the first thing, A-plus talent is attracted to A-plus places, right? And we all have seen that, right? Like, I mean, there's these mafias that have been created over the years, and, you want to work with other really smart people. And one of the kind of expressions I have used that I think helps drive that in something I've tried to indoctrinate at Ripple is this idea of, like, don't confuse activity with progress. Some people think if I'm doing a lot of things, like, it gets to the annual review or something, it's like, they write up a self review, whatever. And you read it and you're like, okay, yeah, you did a lot of things, but it didn't actually move the ball forward towards the objective. I'd rather have somebody do a few things and move the ball forward a lot. And I think this idea of just really emphasizing, don't confuse activity with progress. And I think when you do that, A players, like, they want to be involved with progress. A players want to put their dent in the universe. A players can go make money at lots of places. You can't get them with money. You have to get them with, like, hey, yes, you can make a lot of money at being here, but you can also have an impact on the world. And that to me is the A player experience, if you will.
I love that. When we extrapolate that out and you've got a whole team of A players and you have a world-class culture, at that dinner, we also talked about culture. And I thought you had the most concise, beautiful definition of culture. Can you share that?
I'm not sure which one it was. So.
You probably have a few of them, I think.
Well, one of the things I talk... Well, sorry, maybe lead the witness a little bit more
here. Yeah, I'm trying. I think to paraphrase what you said, I think culture is who you hire,
who you fire, and who you promote. Yeah, that's an important one. I think people lose sight of this. And at times, I think Ripple has... I really value the culture. What says more about your culture than anything else is who you hire. It's being smart about that. And there's sometimes you want to hire someone, but they're not a cultural fit. And it's hard to say no. Because, but recognizing this person isn't going to fit in well here. And that's okay. But then also being smart about and quick about who you fire. And again, just in the last 6 months, we've had this experience. And I was sad to see somebody who I thought was really talented, but just they were not a good fit culturally. And then who you promote, that's the most important one. I think one of the things I'm most proud of at Ripple is there's a bunch of people on our leadership team that started. I mean, our CFO now, he's been in the company, I think, seven, maybe 8 years, and is promoted and promoted and promoted and is now the CFO. The president of the organization, Monica Long, she joined the company 10 years, more than 10 and a half years ago. And, was a director of X, Y, and Z. Now she's president of the whole company.
Wow. It goes back to that progress. A players want progress.
Yeah.
And I'd be curious what you'd have for me here, because one thing is to assemble the talent. And for us, we've got just a really world-class team. The hard part for me is developing the talent and then retaining the talent. Cause if you don't develop them, they're going to leave somewhere else because they need that forward growth because you've hired incredible people. How do you think through maximizing the potential of each person on your team?
Yeah. Look, one of the things I think is hard as a manager is letting people have enough rope to hang themselves.
Yes.
Right. I mean, that's an expression lots of people use, but there's definitely times when I see people doing something who worked for me. I'm like, well, I wouldn't do that. but you know what? I have almost never, in my roughly 25 years of professional experience, I have almost never told someone you have to hire this person or you have to fire this person. There's a bunch of examples where somebody who's worked for me, I'd be like, I don't know why they're like, I don't get it. But if I have to tell them who to hire and who to fire, then they are the wrong person. Right? Like if I don't trust this person who's working for me enough to make hire and fire decisions, then I should get rid of them, not the person underneath them. And so I think to the extent I've helped develop people along the way, it's being that coach and mentor, but not trying to play the game for them.
Interesting. Because otherwise you can't scale if you're always dropping yourself into everything.
Yeah. And look, there are times when I feel like, I can think of some times where I'm like, I knew it wasn't going to work. But, it was okay. They needed to make that mistake and have that experience so they could have that scar tissue and be a better leader themselves.
Yeah.
And that's okay. And by the way, I continue to make mistakes. And I hope the key is, in my opinion, having the humility to identify when you made a mistake, admitting the mistake and learning from it.
Yeah.
And that's okay. But again, back to our earlier point, we've talked about some CEOs who are very, very bad at admitting mistakes.
Yes.
And by the way, I admire the hell out of them. It's not my playbook. It's not how I operate.
I get that. Cause I'm always just trying to understand in hindsight other mistakes people have made. Cause I think experience is the slowest and most painful way to learn.
Yeah.
I'd rather just take your lessons and be like, all right, well, let me keep that in mind so I can actually apply that.
Well, I will give you one other one. You're not asking this, but I'll tell you one of the big mistakes I think that you and I talked about this a little bit one-on-one. As companies grow, they hire more and more people in risk mitigation functions. They hire more lawyers. They hire more HR people. They hire more finance people. And those people, their job is to mitigate risk. But in some of these industries, particularly nascent industries like crypto, like if you're not taking risk, you're dying. And so I think having been around for a while, like creating a culture that embraces risk, it has to tolerate failure. And if you don't tolerate that failure, you're not going to enable the risk. And I feel like you have to keep at least what I think about at Ripple is I want to keep pushing risk. I want us to fail. If we're not failing a little bit, we're not trying hard enough. And I'm glad we have an amazing legal team. We have an amazing finance organization. I love my HR leader. And their job is to at times be like, okay, wait, like we shouldn't do that. You know, sometimes I'm like, I hear you. This is not a democracy. I mean, I'll tell you one other quick story on this that I think is really relevant. The general counsel at Yahoo way back when was a guy named Mike Callahan. He, I think, is an amazing human being and an amazing lawyer. And one of the things he said to me, he's like, Brett, my job and my team's job, I didn't work with him. I wasn't senior enough to do that. But my team's job is to help you understand risk. It's your job to allocate risk. And he's like, if my team is telling you, no, you can't do something, they're not doing their job. Lawyers don't tell you, no, I can't do something. Lawyers say, look, here are the risks. You should make a decision. Now, there are exceptions to that when it comes to criminal activity. And so
right, you have to have the guardrails on.
Yeah, the guardrails have to be there. Yeah. No criminal activity. But there's a whole bunch of stuff that's like, well, wait a minute. Like, yeah, okay, I understand a lawyer thinks there's risk in doing that, but like you have to take risk, particularly in a nascent industry. You know, I mean, was Ripple taking risk by fighting the SEC? 1,000%.
Absolutely.
Was I taking risk by not settling personally with the SEC? 1,000%. Do I regret? Am I glad I took those risks? Of course. Did some of the lawyers advise me maybe I should take this? Yes, they did, as they should have. That's their job.
But you listen to your own compass.
You have to. Again, as companies grow, there's a natural tendency to take fewer risks. And I think when you're in an industry like crypto and blockchain that is growing and dynamic and gonna change a bunch, you have to keep taking risk.
I love this message because I feel like the fear of failure, the fear of rejection, the fear of humiliation.
In life. Not just at a company.
Not just at a company. Yeah. Robs people of their potential like nothing else.
I agree.
Right. There's so much genius and there's so much innovation and so many gifts that have yet to be given to the world because people are so afraid of what their peers are going to think.
Yeah.
And so to create a safe space, we're like, you know what? We're going to go against the freaking matrix here and just like not let our fears be our guide, but we have faith, we have conviction, and like that is powerful stuff.
The hard thing I think is how do you inculcate that into an organization where it's not just at the CEO level, it's not just the executive level? Because I want a director of product management to embrace that same thing. I want an engineering, you know, manager of X, Y, and Z to embrace that same thing. And so the hard part I think is making sure you have a culture, I'll go back to what I said earlier, that encourages risk and tolerates failure. If you don't get the second part, if you don't tolerate failure, people are not going to take risk.
Yeah, I'm like self-reflecting on this right now. I'm like, man, I can be overbearing sometimes because like, for me, it's all about creating raving fans. Like all I want to do is create raving fans that are founders out there.
Right.
But I can see too, when you have such a passion for creating results at a certain level, you can be constrictive and that can be the very thing bottlenecking your company's growth.
Yeah.
Just let people make a few mistakes, celebrate them, move forward.
Yeah.
Are there any TED Talks, books, courses, just personal development things that you've done that you feel like were like asymmetric levers in your personal growth that you think everyone should just either read or watch right now?
Oh, that's a really good one. I'm trying to think. Well, this is a micro example, so it's imperfect. And I kind of alluded to it earlier. The CEO of NVIDIA gave a talk at Stanford. It got some fame, you know, at least in the viral loop, you know, ran for a minute. And I don't know. I think his name is Jensen Huang.
Jensen Huang, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know him. I listened to this guy and I actually sent it to my kids, which by the way, that's the highest praise I can give, right? Like this is something I want my kids to pay attention to.
Wow, yeah.
And, you know, his message was one of like, I wish pain upon you. I wish friction upon you. It was kind of like, and I agree with him that particularly a generation that has been gifted and had immense opportunities, like how much friction have they really had? Have they do they have the grit? Because even as you're describing the like people not taking risk and because they're afraid of rejection, people who have grit are less afraid of failure. They understand that like, okay, yeah, I'm gonna run into some shit and that's okay. Because you know, it's not about how many times you get knocked down. It's about how many times you get up.
Yes.
And like, you gotta keep getting up. And if you've never been knocked down those first couple times, and I say this partly as a parent, like, you know, I've seen my kids get knocked down once or twice. And you know, those first couple times it's, you know, that they've had pretty good lives. Like it's a
big shock.
Yeah. And it, you know, but I'm thrilled in the same way that he was giving these, the CEO of NVIDIA was giving these Stanford students his counsel. You know, I think it was super powerful. Anyway, there's little lessons. I mean, you know, I mentioned I'm in the process of reading the Elon Musk biography and, yeah, you know, I think learning about some of these people, I've met Elon a couple of times. I don't know him per se. And, you know, learning how they choose to operate. And again, it's not that therefore I should embody those attributes. It's more like, okay, this is interesting.
Yeah, I like that. And back to Jensen too. I think he said like suffering builds character. You can't find character at Yale or Harvard. You build character. I mean, through
but
suffering.
There are, that's a gross generalization, of course. There's always people at Yale or Harvard who've been through it.
Right. But it's not the very institution that gave them that. It's the experiences they had to get through to get there. It's, you know, just because you're, I think the main thing is like go out there, take action, fail. You need that to build the character to actually have your big successes.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I feel like that's probably the thing that's missing most in the world today. When you have, it's a, you know.
One of my, I mean, again, not a question you asked, but one of my favorite profiles of, you know, hiring A talent and building an A team is to hire failed entrepreneurs.
Mm.
So that they have a, if they're a failed entrepreneur, I know that they have a risk tolerance that they're willing to take risk. Because to put yourself out there as an entrepreneur, it takes a lot.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. The fact that they failed, I hope means they learned something and they're hungry to prove that they have it.
Yes.
And so I remember, you know, multiple times, and I've worked with recruiters and I've said, look, I want to find a failed entrepreneur to lead this effort.
Yep.
Now, sometimes one of my other favorite interview questions when I'm interviewing someone is, on a scale of 1 to 10, how lucky are you? Sometimes I've found entrepreneurs just seem to continue to fail. They can't quite figure it out. But you know, it's hopefully they're learning along the way and finding people who look at the world as like, they view themselves as lucky and likely to get lucky are the kind of people that
I think they do become self-fulfilling prophecies.
Totally.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I like that a lot. Curious for you, this is a kind of a broad question. We talked about this a little bit, but like, it's always interesting to understand your mental models and what you would want for the world. So I'm curious for you. If you could get the whole world to believe one thing that you deeply believe yourself, what would you want the world to believe?
Well, this is a little bit do as I say, not as I do, because I want to believe and internalize this more, but understanding that your happiness is not dependent upon someone else's happiness, I think is super critical to the world. I think too often we're too worried about what other people think. I think one of the great, you know, viruses of life is things like Instagram, because we're comparing ourselves to, you know, other people all the time. And, you know, comparison is the thief of joy. And for me, if people better understood your happiness is not dependent upon everyone else's happiness, I think that would be good. And I'm not saying that I'm perfect at that.
Yeah.
I try. I try to remember that sometimes, but you know, we're all works in progress.
That's good. I feel like a lot of our best advice that we give to other people is just the advice we also need for ourselves.
Exactly. You know, that is absolutely true.
Like, I'll write like a post on LinkedIn or something to go inspire people. I'm like, shit, I needed that.
Yeah.
You know,
but that's good. You know, that's a good thing to recognize as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Before I ask my last question, where can our listeners find, engage with you online?
The main one for me is Twitter.
Okay.
Yeah, B Garling now, at B Garling House. I'm semi-active. I tend to be a one-trick pony. Well, two-trick pony. One is I tweet about crypto. I tweet about what's going on, you know, to some degree Ripple, but also stuff outside of Ripple, just the crypto industry. The second one is I'm a rabid fan of the Kansas Jayhawks. I'm a graduate of the University of Kansas. Yeah. And, you know, best basketball coach on earth, Bill Self. Anyway, those are the only two things I really tweet about.
So if you want info on those two topics,
you should follow me. Otherwise,
Brad is the number one account on those two topics. Awesome. Well, for me, you know, the name of the show is World Class. And I think when I think about that, I think about being a world class human, being world class in your craft, and just living a world class life. And for me, I think the core of that is really just seeking growth and expansion. I think that that comes from always seeking your next level, not from a place of lack, but from a place of wanting to become more as a human while we're still on this planet. So for you, despite everything you've done so far, building Ripple, operating companies, for you, what do you feel like your next level looks like personally?
I think it's understanding, you know, that success is measured not by bank accounts and size of companies exclusively. It's understanding that success is about the impact you have on people's lives and the interactions you have and the people you touch. I get immense joy, frankly, as a dad, but also in seeing like the next generation of leaders, both inside Ripple and those that I get to interact with outside of Ripple, and kind of bringing them along and helping them along their journey. That's a lot of success for me now, which probably I didn't understand as well how much joy that would bring in my 30s and 40s when I was kind of just work. I was working insane hours, and then you get there, you achieve, you know, success in the kind of maybe more financially capitalistic driven measures, and you kind of realize like, huh, I want something more. And it is a little bit like, how are you putting your dent in the universe? And there's a lot of ways to do that. And some of the people I admire most are not necessarily the people that are the traditionally defined most successful people. That people are like, wow, they have, you know, they've chosen a path less traveled.
Mm, I love that, man. Yeah, I think you graduated on the soul evolution of like, well, okay, I've made a lot of money. I've had a lot of financial success. I've had the status, but now it's like, all right, how can I maximize my impact?
Yeah.
I love that, man. Well, this has been fascinating. I just want to commend you for being courageous, you know, and like going through some real shit and standing your path and paving the way for an industry, really, and being one of the forefront leaders. Just, I'll use the word hero, because I think heroes for me pursue their own principles in the face of all adversity, you know, with a noble intention. So I think you've done some pretty heroic stuff and learned a lot today.
I take that as a huge compliment. I appreciate it. I don't know if I would call myself, like, I don't hold myself in that level.
I know you don't, but I think I can give you that, I think, like with integrity.
I appreciate it immensely.
So thank you so much for sharing, man. I know people are going to love this.
Thank you.
Awesome. Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the World Class Podcast. Don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe across all our platforms. Hit that notification bell so you can get updates on our new episodes, and we'll see you next week.